We were looking at message passing, and the point here was we wanted some way to be able to transfer information between processes that didn't essentially require a punching a hole in the sides of the protection, the address boundaries of the processes. And so we came up with this idea of being able to throw essentially chunks of data between processes and have the processes be able to communicate in that way. So that preserves, in some sense, security in the sense that it maintains the address boundaries. Okay, because essentially, as we'll talk about in a minute, this essentially goes through system calls in the operating system. Does anybody remember what the other characteristic of this is? I mentioned it briefly, I think. It improves flexibility because we can now, once we have processes that communicate by message passing, we can think about doing that favorite operating system trick of sticking a network between two things as opposed to some more lighter weight connection. So we can essentially allow for processes to migrate from one system to another and still maintain communication, assuming you've got that infrastructure that can deliver messages from one box to another. So you have greater flexibility. And there are a lot of systems that are based on message passing. Probably the biggest one is the MPI, which is some sort of grid-based interface that allows huge assemblages of programs to communicate across the country running on supercomputers and so forth and so on. But it's a pretty nice mechanism to use. And it's recognized by, it's being increasingly recognized by programming languages. So, for example, I think I mentioned the Go programming language has this notion of channels, which is essentially the same thing as message passing. Then we started to look at mechanisms for doing that, and we came up with essentially three design axes that you can look at when you discover or design various message passing systems. And those were the ability to name, the ability to, what was the second one? That was the third one. Buffer, right, yeah. So, and this is, and it was at this point that I started rushing through things, but I want to go back and do this in a little bit more detail because these are actually important ideas that are going to come up over and over again. Let me introduce them here so that they are familiar when we come up with them. So to do that, let's just think about a general interface to message passing. So you're interested in designing some sort of set of system calls, for example, to allow for message passing. And so the obvious two that you need are to send and to receive. And in both cases, it seems clear you're going to have a message here. In the case of the send, it's an in parameter. And in the case of a receive, it's an out parameter. Do we need anything else? Right. We could have a parameter here that gives you, in the case of the send, it would be the address or the name of the receiver. And in the other case, we would have something that the would be the address of the sender. But do we need that? Okay, so what would happen if I didn't have it? Right, you would have, without the first parameter here, without this name parameter, you would have what's known as broadcast communication. And in particular, the kind that we'd be looking at would be publish, subscribe, which is usually abbreviated PubSub. Processes would express an interest in messages that are broadcast over a particular channel, and then anybody can broadcast messages over their channel, and it will be received by any process that happens to be listening. But even here, notice that we still have some kind of name, except we're no longer naming processes, but channels. So you can think of them as, for example, everybody that's interested in disk traffic would be listening to the disk channel, or anybody that's interested in TTY traffic would be listening to the TTY channel. To bring things back to the model that I had talked about in the previous lecture, this would essentially be the receiver, and this would be the sender. And there's all kinds of games that we can play with respect to how we want to define this. So one obvious point is that the receiver might want to receive from anybody. So you might want to have a wild card. And that would be useful if you're implementing something like a server, right? Because a server will essentially accept requests from anyone and then return requests to the specific individual. And then the receiver could do sort of a quasi-pub sub by doing multicast or broadcast or whatever. So there's all kinds of interesting games here. Actually, there could also be a third parameter here, and that would be the... Oh, no, never mind. That's right here. That's the sender. Although if you go with a wild card, you need some way to know what the sender is so that you could return a response. All right, so that was naming. We did naming, so let me just make sure. The name of the sender and receiver. Okay, and yeah, so it was at this point that we stopped. So let me go on. There's actually two kinds of naming, and those are direct and indirect. Direct naming is essentially I want to send to that process. So this is, in a sense, process to process. The other approach, which turns out to be useful, is indirect, in which the two endpoints, and now we'll just simplify things and assume that we have point-to-point communication here, the two endpoints communicate through an intermediary. All right, now that intermediary has lots of different names. It can be called a port. It can be called a channel. It can be called a mailbox. One of the previous times I taught this class, the operating system provided a mailbox that processes could access. And the picture looks, with indirect naming, the picture looks like this. You have one process, P1, and then you have this channel, I'll call it, and then P2. And the naming then is with respect to this channel. And this turns out to be a very nice, flexible way to deal with inter-process communication, because now you can have multiple senders and receivers without really having to worry too much about the naming. If you have direct naming, of course, having multiple senders and receivers now starts requiring coordination. That's a good question. All right, so let's see. How do I want to answer this? Why don't you hold on to that question? We'll come back to it when we talk about buffering. The answer is yes. You can do that, either one of those two things. Or actually other things too. Right, so, then what happens is the channel essentially becomes a proxy for the two endpoints. So now it only becomes necessary to find the name of the channel involved as opposed to the endpoint. So you could replace a single server, for example, with multiple servers to improve performance. But the only thing the senders need to know is the name of the channel. Whereas if there was direct naming, then you would have to somehow broadcast the names of all of the servers that are available, and then the sender would have to figure out which one the best server is to use. And it's very complicated, but with a channel in indirection, it goes much simpler. It's much easier to use. But, of course, it adds another step. If you have direct communication, you essentially have a crossing of two boundaries, whereas if you have indirect, you're crossing at least three. You're crossing two boundaries. You have at least three. This one from P1 to the channel, and then from the channel to P1. So there's three boundaries in there that you've crossed, as opposed to just two. There's lots of interesting things we could talk about with respect to naming, but I think I will skip that for now. And the next issue that you have to deal with is the notion of buffering. And this is actually sort of important with respect to indirect, but also with respect to indirect. And the question becomes, how many messages can the receiver receive without acting on any of the messages? And this is actually a question that applies in both directions, both on the sender and the receiver side, but it's actually more crucial on the receiver side because, for example, if you're in a server relationship with the sender being the client and the receiver being the server, it's quite likely that there are going to be many, many senders per receiver. So the server could be receiving lots of different messages. And the question is, how much storage should be devoted to those messages that are coming in? And what are some answers to that? How could we answer that as designers? what might you say, what might you give as an answer to the question, how much storage? This question is perhaps easier to think about if you think about indirect communication, because it's the same question, right? Now the question becomes, how big should the channel be in terms of the ability to store messages? So how many slots are there in the mailbox? That's another way to think about it. So what's one way to answer that question? Okay, so one question is, how would you characterize that size? Right, infinite. It's infinitely big. Well, effectively infinite. You're going to eventually run out of space, right? But you probably, if you're like Google, you're probably adding disk faster than disk is being used. Right, so, but it's effectively infinite. Let me say that. All right. So any client that sends a message to the server, that message will be stored someplace until the server can get around to picking it up. Now this is nice from the point of view of the communicants, because now they don't have to worry about coordination over space. But of course it's very difficult to implement in the operating system, as I hope you're beginning to appreciate now. And it also can be expensive, because if you allow people to use gigabytes of storage, they're going to use it. But that's certainly one answer. So what's the next step down? Half of infinity is infinity, right? So, right, you have some finite bounded number. When the channel gets created, for example, or when the process gets created, you specify as one of the parameters to the system call that's doing the creation the amount of space that you want to devote to be able to store messages. So you can store 10 messages or 5 or 5,000. So this gives you a bounded amount. And then we have the interesting question, well, what happens when it's full? What happens when you run out of space? And that's what we'll get to the third one. And then, of course, the last possibility, none, exactly. And this essentially flips around the advantages of effectively infinite. Effectively infinite is really nice for the senders and receivers. They essentially don't have to think. But it's very difficult for the operating systems implementer, because they essentially have to provide this infinite-looking storage. This flips it around. This is extremely easy to implement in terms of operating system, but it's completely inconvenient for the sender and receiver. Because unless the sender and receiver are right there waiting, then you've got problems. It's essentially like finite, except always. You don't even have the possibility of there being space in the mailbox. For example, the mailbox is essentially either empty or full. Now we can go back to your question, which, again, remind me? Oh, okay. So in the case of multiple receivers, what happens there? Or if you're doing some kind of broadcast is another possibility. So let's talk about multiple distribution then, which has the name broadcast, also known as multicast. It's kind of like the pub-sub model that we had talked about earlier. Here, there are also a number of choices. So what's one possibility? To draw the picture, so we have a sender here, and it's sending out a message which explodes into a bunch of, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say sender, let me say client, and then servers. And the question is, when the message hits that distribution point, what happens? Now, of course, I'm doing this sort of metaphorically, because we're still in the same computing system. We're not going out, even though I'm using sort of networky terms here, we are not going out over a network. We are still within a single box. So we are providing distribution within a single box. So this question becomes a little bit easier if you're talking about a network. But inside a single box, it becomes a little bit more interesting. So what are our choices? And I guess you gave them to us, so why don't you tell us?
Make a copy.
Right. There's two possibilities. One is to make a copy and then distribute that copy to each of the servers. What's the advantage to that? Actually, is there an advantage? There is, I guess, kind of an advantage to that. What's the advantage there? If you think about how to implement it, the operation itself isn't really the problem. It's the data that you have. That you have multiple copies of the data. So while it may be an advantage to have only one operation, that advantage is pretty much overshadowed by the existence of multiple instances of the data. The one advantage that you have is the operating system has minimal involvement. And I will justify that when we look at the other possibility. The disadvantage, of course, is you're using a lot of resources. You're losing extra resources making copies of these messages. And that includes time, right, because you have to actually make the copies and distribute them. So not only does it involve space in terms of the messages themselves, but it also includes time to make the copies. Another possibility? Yes. Well, I mean, from one point of view, you're always going to be making copies, right? But so the question is not so much whether you should do copying or not, but how many copies should you make? Or actually, that's not even that, because, of course, the answer is if you have N servers, you're going to make N copies. So it's not whether or not you make copies. The answer is always going to be yes. Although, actually not. What is one way you can implement this really cheaply, and with respect to the operating system anyway? What is one way you can do this kind of behavior with respect to the operating system and have the same effect, but actually not do it like this? You could do multiple point-to-point. Right? So rather than do this, you can do this. The operating system provides a single point-to-point channel for communication, and then the client has multiple channels, and if it wants to send to multiple servers, it sends multiple times. That's really easy, but of course it's inconvenient for the client. And it's also difficult to set up because if you have a varying number of servers, this is much better than this. Because then some aspect of the operating system, which is going to be knowledgeable about the number of servers anyway, is able to handle this relatively easily, but and the client need not be concerned about it at all, versus this, where in fact the client really shouldn't have any knowledge of the servers in general, and then would require some mechanism to communicate that knowledge. So it becomes a lot more complicated. And, of course, it's also expensive. This is essentially a constant-time operation as far as the client is concerned. Right? You just send a message once and you're done. This is a linear operation. You have N connections. It's going to take you order N time. So we can, in fact, avoid copying. But even here, you're not, because you're making the copy at the client as it sends out over the connections. So even there, you're doing copying. So this is like early copying. This is intermediate copying. And then what's the final choice? You have early, intermediate, and late copying. So what does late copying look like? What would that look like? Well, first of all, which of those entities would be responsible for doing late copying? The servers, exactly. The servers say, okay, I'm ready to receive this next piece of information, so then they would make a copy of the message that's being sent. But a copy from where? Where is it? Where is that message that it can make the copy of? Because the sender is done with it. It's like, oh, or the client, I should say, is done with it. It's like, I sent that out microseconds ago. It's in the channel, but the channel is what? It's an operating system instruction. So the copy is somewhere in the operating system. So here we're copying from the operating system to the server. So the operating system has to maintain some sort of internal storage so that these messages can be sent. And which one of these is best depends on your circumstances. This is the simplest, because essentially just provide point-to-point connections and perhaps some way of doing registration of servers at the client end.
Yeah, like how many needed.
Sorry? Like how many there are, when a new one comes in, when an old one leaves, things like that. Which is actually kind of complicated. You probably don't want the client to do this. I mean, the client wants, you know, genome data from some database in Switzerland. It doesn't care that they're in Zurich and Bern. They just want that data. But if you sort of have to force them to deal with it, well, that's an opportunity for another library, apparently. Then the other possibilities become more complicated. This one is not too bad, and then this one is perhaps the worst because it requires this ability to store. And then you've got all kinds of interesting questions, like when do you get rid of the operating system copy? It's not quite as obvious as it looks. So this is actually pretty interesting. And with respect to practical matters, it's usually done with respect to broadcast. which is pretty easy to do, because broadcast, particularly in the kind of pub sub, is like either you get it or you don't. The data goes in flight, and if you're listening, you get a copy of it, but once it's passed, that's it. You're not going to get a copy of it. That is the buffering question. And then the final question is synchronization. And this is essentially the question, what happens when one of the two sides is not ready? An alternative way to think about this is if you have finite buffers or none, let's just say non-infinite, what happens if the channel is full? I'll concentrate on this one, what happens when one of the two sides is not ready. So, for example, what happens when the receiver is doing this, but the sender is not doing any sending, or alternatively, the sender is ready to send, but the receiver is not there to receive it. So what are our choices? What are our possible ways to deal with this issue? And again, if you want to think concretely, think about, and this is a good example of the use of none. Suppose that we have a zero buffer channel, okay, which is essentially, you can think of it like a direct connection between the sender and the receiver. What happens if the receiver is not ready? What are your choices? Let's pick the receiver. If the receiver is busy working on some aspect of the previous request and a sender wants to send a new request, then the server is not ready to receive that request. So essentially two things can happen. The sender can wait, which in the jargon is known as blocking, or can receive an error message, which is known as non-blocking. Right, so your two choices are to have, there's actually a third choice. What would the third choice be? Okay, so that would be so it's the non-infinite case, but remember what our conditions are here. And in particular, what happens if the channel is full? Since we're talking about non-finite buffering, then there is a possibility that the channel will be full. And what happens in that case? Again, it's effectively the same as the receiver is not ready to receive the data. And we have two choices. We have sort of the obvious one of, well, I'll just wait. And then the other one is like, the hell with it. Just give me an error message and I'll go do something else. And then there's a third choice. Right, but the sender is blocked. The sender cannot do anything other than stand around and wait. So the sender itself is blocked, and as you will see in the second programming assignment, what that means is the operating system says, this process is not doing anything, yank it, and replace it with something that is, a process that is. So that process becomes blocked because it makes no progress. Whereas if it gets an error message, it says, okay, you know, it's like a busy signal, right? If you are... Well, this actually is not a particularly good example, but if you call someone up and you get a busy signal, what do? Do you stand there until the busy signal goes away, or do you just hang up and try again later? Right? So, but if you stand there and wait, you're blocked because you're not doing anything else other than listening to a busy signal. Same thing. So at that point, you're blocked. You're not doing anything else. Right? Or it's true, you're waiting, but that's not useful. So the third way... Yeah, that's one possibility. Just throw it into the void, and if it falls on the floor, oh well. That's like that's the broadcast when no one's listening. It just sails by and goes out the door. So that's a possibility. I mean, the operating system looks at this and says, "Is there anybody ready to receive it?" And if the answer is no, just throws it away. Wait with a timeout. I'm willing to wait for 30, 50 milliseconds. And if the server frees up in the next 50 milliseconds, send the message. Otherwise, give me back an error message. So that's an intermediary between just blocking until you are able to send the message and not just finding out that you failed and going on and doing something else. And you have a similar approach on the receiver. So you have a server that issues a receive request waiting for a message from a client, and suppose no clients are sending messages. Again, what can you do? Well, you can block and wait for a message to come in. You can get an indication that there are no messages, so fail immediately, or you can wait for a period of time for a message and then fail. In the case of a server, it makes more sense to do blocking I/O, but again, that's a choice you can make based upon the nature of the server. So you have the same choices with respect to the receiver. Another term for non-blocking is, another term for blocking is synchronous. In this case, synchronous message passing. And we'll also talk about synchronous I.O. when we get to device I.O., same thing. And in this case, it is asynchronous. This will actually be important when we get to threads, because there's an interesting question as to what happens when a thread does a blocking operation. Not necessarily message passing, but any kind of blocking operation. This is also, these are also terms that apply to essentially any operation a process can do, right? Because there are some operations that can block. For example, resource allocation, right? We'll talk about this when we talk about resource management. The resources may not be available. So the question is, what happens then? Well, it's similar to sending a message. In fact, you might want to think in terms of buffers being resources. Exactly the same problem. And I believe that's all. Buffering, non-finite and infinite, in quotes. Synchronous, requester returns immediately. Okay, that's it. Any questions about this? That concludes our discussion on IPC. And we can now go on and talk about threads. So let me see. I guess I'll go over here and do this. All right, so this is a question I don't understand. The question is, so is asynchronous cancellation why a scheduler is implemented? I'm not quite sure I understand what asynchronous cancellation means, but we're jumping ahead to the next set of lectures in the next section. I can just tell you that a scheduler principally is involved with dealing with resource management. So that's what a scheduler is for. Now, to the extent that resource management involves asynchronous cancellation, then the answer is yes, but that is a relatively minor part of what a scheduler is about. There are lots of other more significant issues associated with scheduling. And in fact, asynchronous cancellation is not so important with respect to scheduling, but is actually fairly important with respect to threads. So we'll talk about that a little tonight, I hope, if we can get to it. Oh, now we can have fights with the guy next door. Who can lecture louder? That's about threads, so we'll get to that. Why are we talking about threads? Apart from the fact that it's the next chapter. Why is there a chapter on threads?
They're important.
Why are they important? There's actually a more fundamental reason. You're right, and we'll talk about that, but there's actually a more fundamental reason. Even if I'm not interested in doing one thing more than one thing at a time. Because I understand that doing one more than one thing at a time, while it's convenient and natural, is extremely hard to do. And this actually goes to this question as to whether should a web server not run, or should a web server run as a single-threaded versus a multi-threaded program or architecture, to give it a more dignified term? My answer is, it really needs to be single-threaded, because that's way easier than doing multi-threading. But we'll perhaps get into that. Probably not tonight, because we probably won't have any time. So, yeah, that's right, but there's a more fundamental reason. Even if I'm interested in only doing one thing at a time, I still am interested in threads. And why is that? I know I identified this in... I guess I should stay away from the door then, huh? I identified this earlier when we talked about processes. Remember, we talked about processes, and we said that you can identify a process with its task control block, or process control block, or however you want to call it. And that's essentially a bag of all the resources that a process needs to run, except for one. What was that one? The CPU, exactly. But, of course, a process needs a CPU in order to execute. So the question is, what is the nature of the abstraction of this, or how is the CPU presented to the process in order to enable it to execute? And the answer is, as a thread. Actually, I should say threads are the last resource needed. So threads are the OS abstraction that enables a process to actually execute. In order to execute a process, you dedicate a thread to that at least one thread to that process. And that is depicted thusly. That's a single-threaded process in execution because it has the thread. And of course, we can get this idea of having more than one thing done by putting multiple threads, by devoting multiple threads to a process. Okay? That's what a thread is. And that's why they're so important. Now, before we go on, we should perhaps justify this. Why am I being so obscure? I mean, how does this give us any advantage over saying, just give the process the CPU and be done with it? What leverage do we get by thinking about execution in terms of threads as opposed to just saying, oh, you know, this process is in the CPU versus that process? Perhaps a somewhat more positive way to say this. Well, one answer is more or less depicted here. The first one is you can now think about doing more than one thing within the same process. More than one thing doesn't sound dignified, so I'd like to say something else. More than one activity. Oh, that actually reminds me. Does anybody do Android programming in here? Someone mentioned that I should talk about this, and I've been forgetting about it all the while. So someday when we have some time, maybe if you want to bring it up again. But essentially, I mean, one of the reasons that you should be really working hard on your operating system is, I mean, yeah, it's a toy. It's useless. But essentially, you are doing exactly Android programming. This is exactly how you write Android programs. Well, eventually, as soon as you get it figured out and working. Now, Android is a little bit, in my opinion, a lot more complicated. But essentially, you're writing a series of activities, which sort of brought it to mind. And that's essentially how Android works. You have a bunch of things that execute, and then you flip over to the user interface, and then you flip back into the operating system or Android. So by doing the programming assignments, you're getting a taste of Android programming. And it is as unbearable as writing operating systems. So we can do more than one activity within the same process. Anything else? Any other opportunities for this? We could do that before, right? I mean, I drew that picture earlier when we talked about IPC. So what? Why is this an advantage over IPC? Because we have this. We have IPC, so we can create that word processor thing that we had before, which takes less amount of time.
Multiple threading.
All right. And why is that? You're correct. It's more efficient because resource allocation. Okay, there's a more fundamental reason. Less resource allocation. But more fundamentally, two important issues. First one is you're not crossing protection boundaries. You're within, I mean, look at this picture. These two threads are running in the same process. So there's no crossing protection boundaries in order for these two threads to communicate. And the second reason is more or less related to the first, but is a little bit more specific. You are involving the operating system less. You're making fewer system calls, which means that you're going to have more efficient execution. So you have less operating system involvement, and to a certain extent, the involvement that you get from the operating system is cheaper because people work hard to make access to threads efficient. So these are, I suspect, the two principal ones. There are some other reasons that you might want to do it, but for the most part, that boiled down to the ability to do more than one thing in a process, and it's more efficient in terms of providing for this ability to do multiple activities within a particular execution. All right, so let us now consider why these things are true. And we'll do that. Let's see. All right, so let's start talking about the thread abstraction. So I've drawn the picture over here as a bunch of threads within a process, but they're actually a little bit more specifically located within a process. Where is that location? So here's our process, and we have resources inside the process, and where are the threads? So here's a thread. Where is that thread? The top. Oh, that's true. But with respect to resources that are part of the process, so this is a process. Right, that's a process. It has resources, and it has a particular resource. That's what the thread represents, and that should give you a cue as to what the resource the thread is involved in. Program. The thread is executing the sequence of instructions in a program. All right, and you may have heard this term, thread of execution, through code. Okay, and that's essentially where it comes from. So the thread is responsible for actually executing the program. This is why it is the active part. Yes?
Is there another process inside that program, inside that thread?
That's actually a good question. The answer is, let me say yes, but it's a particular kind of process. In fact, why don't I just tell you what the answer is? Does anybody know what another term for threads is? Another term for a thread is a lightweight process. Or LWP. Okay, and that comes down to this particular reason for using threads. It's more efficient in the sense that it is lighter weight. It can do more things without incurring the operating system overhead, so it is less costly. So in one sense, the answer is yes. But it is a very resource-poor process in the sense that if you take a thread out of a process, it can't do anything because it has no code to execute. A thread itself has no code. It does have some small amount of resource, which is another reason this is lightweight. Okay. But it doesn't have any code to execute. So from that point of view, it's not really a process. There's a symbiosis going on here between threads and processes themselves. So you can think about, and you will occasionally see threads referred to as LWPs, lightweight processes, but it seems to make more sense to think about them as threads. Less confusing. Okay, so what else did I want to say? So that's where the threads are. Now, of course, it needs the program, but in addition, it has access to all the other resources that the process has. So from that point of view, it inherits all the other resources. So, for example, all the storage, which makes sense, right, because the program is, in fact, in storage. Files. So these threads have access to everything, all the resources within the individual processes. And again, this gives us a way to have efficient inter-thread communication, right? Because the individual threads, can essentially use the resources in the process to communicate with one another. Again, maintaining the protection boundary and not crossing it. So it's very efficient inter-thread communication. So it's ITC, inter-thread communication. And it's actually quite natural. I suspect we'll have time. We can take a look at a simple example of using threads, and you'll see it's quite natural. You actually specify it in terms of global variables, which of course are evil, but that's how you would do it. So if we have multiple threads, they all have access to the same resources, and therefore they're able to easily communicate. So let us consider this notion of lightweight process. So if we take a thread as being a process, so what did I identify a process as? What did we identify a process as? It's a bag of resources. Almost all the resources needed to execute. So what would you anticipate an LWP to be? Exactly. It's a smaller bag of resources. It is all the resources needed by the LWP. But you have to be a little careful not to execute, right, because it doesn't have, for example, a program. So an LWP is, maybe we can call it not so much a bag as a, what's a smaller bag-like thing? A wallet, yeah, I suppose. Let's call it a bag. Baglet. Yeah, I was thinking about satchel. Or a pouch, yeah. So it's a bag of thread resources, and it's relatively parsimonious, again, from your operating system experience, although perhaps not so much from your first programming assignment. What kind of resources would you anticipate to be? What is the bare minimum of resources needed for a thread to execute, apart from the code? Exactly, the register set. Because ultimately, the thread will run in the CPU, and if it runs in the CPU, it has state in the form of, for example, registers, and that state has to be stored somewhere when the thread gets flipped out of the CPU, and that's one of the places it goes. What else? In particular? It's got memory space in the process, right? But you're right. There is a particular kind of memory it needs. Stack. The thread needs its own stack to execute. And that makes sense, right? Because you have multiple threads, and they can't be sharing a single stack because they would then conflict with one another. So each of them has their own stack. The third piece is depends upon the nature of the operating system, but it could have things like signal handlers or other kinds of control state. So I'll just say control state. So signal masks, for example, what signals, which we haven't really talked about yet, what signals would a thread react to? Another possibility is priority. You can have threads with priority, which we'll talk about when we talk about scheduling. And so the priority associated with the thread would be part of its state. And there are other kinds of state. And then the last part of, or the last piece you usually find, is what's known as thread-specific state. So this is a relatively modest amount of resources, particularly if we don't have things like thread-specific state. Generally speaking, except for the stack, which is actually not stored as... Is that true? No, let me not say that. It is, in fact, stored as part of the thread resources. If we skip the stack, we're looking at less than 100 words, let's say. Right? Unless you have a really capacious register set, you're looking at 32-bit or maybe 64-bit registers, some floating point registers, a few other control registers. So you're not looking at a tremendous amount of register space. There isn't a tremendous amount of control space, maybe a couple of words encoded in bits. So, except for the stack, of course, then you don't have a lot of state. And then the thread specific state, that's dependent upon the nature of the threads. Which essentially means that, first of all, you can have a lot of them, right, as opposed to process control blocks, which run like maybe multiple K. These are relatively modest. Because essentially the reason we're interested in this is that these are all kernel space storage units. The stack and the thread-specific stuff is from the process. So that can be huge. We don't really care about that because we have essentially infinite process space. But the actual storage for the blocks, the task control blocks, which I guess I didn't identify here, that comes from the kernel, and that is limited space. The thing I just said, the bag of thread resources is known as the thread control block, or TCB, in relation to the PCB, the process control block. Okay, so that's essentially the basics of threads. They execute in and share the resources of the containing process. They have a small set of state, which makes them relatively cheap and lightweight, which is where the lightweight process name comes from. And that's about it for threads. Not a very complicated concept. Any questions? Okay, so there are two fundamental limits on threads. First is the amount of resource space. And that's effectively infinite. Now, again, that's infinite in quotes because, if you allocate billions of threads and you only have 4 billion primary store, you're going to end up allocating one word per thread, which is not enough. But effectively, you can allocate as many of them as you want. But that's resource. The other resource, of course, is the CPU. And generally speaking, the CPU resource is much more limited than the rest of the resources. And that's the principal constraint. So the limits are other resources, effectively infinite. CPU, on the other hand, is the limiting resource. by limiting here, actually, here we put infinite in quotes, and here we put limiting in quotes. Because, again, if we have the ability to move threads in and out of the CPU, then we have effectively infinite CPUs. But the problem is you have to move the thread into the CPU in order for it to work. So as you increase the threads past the ability of the CPU to handle them, then you degrade performance. But you can still do it if you want. I mean, if you're satisfied with degraded performance in the number of threads that you have, you can still do it. So in that sense, it is, again, unlimited. But as a practical matter, you have to pay attention to the matching between your threads and the available CPUs. And when you do that, that's what your main concern is with respect to performance. I should say, depending upon how it's implemented, there may be other operating system resources devoted to threads. And that's another hard limit, similar to the limit that you have on processes. Right? You can't have an infinite number of processes because each process chews up some number of kilobytes of kernel space. Right? So eventually you're going to run out of process space. In some cases, some operating systems, well, probably most operating systems, devote a small amount of space, not as large as the process, but some space to each thread. And again, that serves as a limit. So there is other kernel or operating system state. And that, in a sense, represents the hardest limit because you only have a finite amount of that. You can multiplex the CPU, but you can't multiplex this stuff. But again, other operating systems don't or have absolutely minimal state. So those are the limits. And, I mean, people just may arbitrarily say, no, you can't have more than 25 threads for no reason other than no one would ever want to use more than 25 threads. That's sort of an arbitrary limit. Okay, what was I going to say? All right, so that's it for threads. That's pretty much it. Now, the interesting questions that are left to us to ask is, or are, how are they used and how are they implemented? I've sort of given you the general idea, but this is sort of a static view. We need to know what the dynamic view is. So which is more interesting to people, how they're used or how they're implemented? Let's go with how they're used. There's essentially two ways, or actually three ways to get threads. Yeah, I think this will work out well. I suspect what we'll do is we'll just run out the period talking about how you would use them. And then that leaves us the next lecture to discuss how they're implemented, which is a little bit more complicated. So you have native threads, which are essentially threads in the operating system. It's a little bit different from kernel threads, but they are threads that are natively supported by the operating system. Then you have libraries. Sometimes native threads are called green threads, but that notation is actually kind of confused because they also talk about green threads in Java, which, as far as I can tell, is a slightly different interpretation. So you might want to avoid that, but you will hear occasionally green threads, and usually what they're talking about is some kind of natively supported thread. Then the other possibility is system libraries that implement threads. And the example here, the standard one, is pthreads and POSIX threads. And Windows has one, which I think is like the Win32 thread API. And these are, as the name suggests, a library of thread routines. They straddle user space and the operating system. So native threads are entirely in the operating system. System libraries straddle the two. And then the third, of course, is entirely in user space. Those are user space threads. So you have these three possibilities. And user space threads are a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time when I was younger in school implementing user space thread packages. And in fact, if you go on my GitHub account, you will find a really simple user space thread package written in C that you can run, you can play with and run. It's, it's like maybe 30 lines of code, not very complicated. So this is where threads come from. And let's figure out how you would go about using them. And I will take the model of POSIX. So I'll have quasi-POSIX threads. P-threads were the precursors to POSIX, as well as POSIX has some other influences, but principally it was P-threads. How many people know C here? It's not really important. Nobody? Oh, well. Because that's what we're going to write programs in. So essentially a C program is a bunch of functions, one of which is called main. And let's think of something to do. Anybody have an interesting application they want to build that would, let's see, I have to think, what did I do here? Did I do anything? We could do the boring client server, but does anybody have an application in mind? Alright, let's do the boring client server. In the previous lecture, we talked about the possibility of having a producer that creates widgets, and then it sends those widgets into a buffer, and then from the other side, we have a consumer that eats those widgets and does something else with them. We don't really care. So this is a producer, this is a classic producer-consumer architecture. In this case, we are using independent processes, right? So these are protection boundary, and then we have a channel between them, which is the motivation behind talking about this in the first place. Now what we'll do is we'll stuff all of that into one process using threads. So we'll create a bunch of threads, and one of the things we need is a producer. So we're going to have some function which will have a will not return anything. And it will receive a queue because we are good programmers and try and avoid global variables. And what does the producer do? It essentially enqueues widgets. So in a loop, it creates a widget by some magic function f, and then it essentially enqueues that, and that's it. Then it loops around and creates another widget. So this is essentially just writing widgets into the buffer. We are not going to worry about whether or not the buffer gets full. We'll assume we have infinite space. We have a consumer function which accepts a queue. And what does it do? Well, we have an infinite loop, and it essentially dequeues a widget from the queue into W and then munges it somehow and then loops around and goes for a new widget. Okay, so this is our P function, and this method, actually this is a function now, we're running C code, these are functions, is the consumer. Now let's write main. So what does main need to do? It needs to create two threads, one for the producer and one for the consumer. So we can, producer is equal to, so we need to do thread create, and we need to specify a bunch of parameters, like, for example, how big is the stack, or you may actually want to pass in the memory that you use for the stack, the control state, what signals will it react to, what is its priority, and then if you're passing individual state. But we're not going to do any of that. So you have a bunch of parameters here that you want to specify, and the last parameter will be the function that that thread executes. Again, we have the thread working in a program, and we have to tell it where to work. So it's going to be working in, since this is the producer thread, in producer. And because the producer has a parameter, we have to specify that parameter. So we'll pass in the queue. And there we go. We have a thread. Now we're going to do it again for the consumer. We're going to tcreate. This time it's going to be the consumer. Now those create, it depends, again, it depends on how your library is implemented, but generally speaking, libraries will create threads and then treat the execution as a separate activity. So we've created these two threads, which essentially means we have allocated thread control blocks for them, and then we have to kick them off, which would be something like thread run. That's the producer and the consumer. And that's it. Now the threads are executing. And they are communicating with one another through this queue. But we need a queue, and we have a couple of choices here. One possibility is to declare the queue in main and then pass it in as a parameter. Another possibility is to declare it as a global variable, and then you don't need to pass it in as a parameter because, again, these threads are just functions, so they have access to the global's variables declared in this particular file. All right, that's relying on the C scoping rules. Or you can be a little bit more software engineering about it, and you can bound the scope of the queue by declaring it in main and then pass it in as an argument. Either way is fine. Now, does anybody have any questions about that? It's pretty straightforward once you understand what queues are for. All right, well, I have a question. What's doing these calls? Exactly. There's a thread that was allocated when the process was created. So we, in fact, have three threads. We have the original thread, And now we have the producer and consumer thread. So three threads are running. The original thread created and then ran the producer, created and then ran the consumer. Then what happens? At some point, right. But my question is, what happens to the main thread, which is the thread that's running main? Right, so now we have three threads, one thread in main, one thread in the producer, and one thread in the consumer. In what sense? Controlling them how? I mean, where is it in this picture I've drawn? Why is that a problem? I mean, is it something to worry about? Perhaps this is just foolishness. Oh, I see what you're saying. All right, now we can go back to our earlier discussion. Good point. I wasn't clear. These are non-blocking operations. Okay, so these are both typically, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. In other words, what that means is the main thread executes T run P, right, which essentially schedules P for execution and then returns. Then it calls T run C, which again schedules C for execution and returns. So it doesn't wait for P to execute to completion, fall out of turn, and then execute C. Why would it not do that? Why is that not a particularly useful thing for it to do, behavior to have? I've been repeatedly saying, well, it depends on what you want to do, how it behaves, right? Whether you block or don't block, or whether you have infinite space or finite space, those are all decisions that you might want to make. Why would you not want to make this decision to have T-run be a non-blocking process, be a non-blocking execution, or system call, as it turns out? Yes, it will, in fact, and that's going to be the subject of the lecture in two sections when we talk about synchronization and deadlock. That's true, but there's even a more basic problem with that. Exactly, you'd only have one running thread, right? Because what happens? Main comes in and then calls P. P starts running. Now, main is also running, but it's blocked, so it's not doing anything, right? So P is running. So we still have one running thread. But the point here was to have multiple threads running at the same time. Right? So to have a blocking system call that runs a thread is ridiculous. It's not a sensible decision that you would make. So you actually want non-blocking, because then the thread comes out of the run and then goes on and starts the next thread. So at the end here, and this is actually what my question was, after the main thread falls out of T-run, we have three threads running, the main thread and then the two producer and consumer threads. And my question is, what happens, and let me make it more explicit, so here's the closing bracket. What happens when the main thread comes out of T-run, the consumer? And this is actually a really complicated question, and this is one of the things that kills me every time I use threads in Java. Or, for that matter, P-threads, although P-threads or POSIX threads are a little bit easier to understand. But let's just take this example right here. Okay, what would you anticipate happening in this case? I guess I'm not understanding your point. Right, but remember, it's a thread, so it's executing instructions. And what instructions is it executing? Essentially, main falls off the end of the process. Right, it falls off the end of main and returns. When you return from main in a C program, what happens? That's the end of the program. You're done. Okay, so that's not what you want. You don't want to fall off the end of main here. So what you need is you need some form of synchronization between the threads that have been kicked off and the thread that kicked them off. So we've talked about the ability to create and run threads, and that's one set of routines in the library. The next set of routines that we'll talk about, and since we're probably going to run out of time, I'll mention all three of them, is synchronization, inter-thread synchronization. And then the third class of routines are like maintenance and control routines. These would be things that, for example, allow you to adjust the priority of a thread, or to interrupt a thread, or to kill a thread, all kinds of routines that would affect the behavior of the thread, either directly or indirectly. I will finish up by talking about synchronization. So if we draw a picture of what that main routine is doing, we have the main thread, and it's creating two parallel threads, the producer and the consumer. And this is, although I've used the term create, it is known in the literature as fork, which is the old term, and in fact it's the term that's still used in Unix, for creating new executable entities, whether they be processes or, in this case, threads. And I pointed out that if we don't do anything, then main will fall off, the main thread will fall off the end of main, and that ends the program. So we need to have some form of synchronization and with respect to the main thread and the two threads it kicked off. And so how would you complete this picture then? So this is the initial side. What would the final side look like? Exactly. They all come back down together. And they can do it at different times. For example, the producer can eventually say, all right, I'm done producing widgets. That's it. And then the consumer, of course, has to work a little bit longer and essentially empty the buffer. And then it can say it's done. At this point, the main thread can now fall off the end and terminate the program. Okay, these points here are known as join points, after the name of the function that you use. And so the kind of synchronization, the basic synchronization you can use in threads is known as fork join synchronization. So we come back over here, and we would add T join, the producer, the consumer, and then we could fall off the end of main. And you have a number of options. You can return a value. So the individual threads, if we were actually writing procedures that were to be used as threads, we could put things in here like tthread exit, which would be able to let the thread return a value to any thread that's joining it. Right, so the value returned by the thread would then appear as the return value of the join. And, of course, you can get a lot more fancy. Here I have to make a choice. Should I wait for P first or wait for C first? And I've given you an argument that says, well, you probably want to wait for P because that's going to be done first. And then sometimes later C is going to drain the buffer and exit. But in less obvious cases, it's not clear. And, in fact, it may be crucial to wait on the right thread, the earliest terminating thread. So you have kinds of advanced joins where you can specify sets of threads to wait on, and when any one of those terminates, then you can join with it. So there's all kinds of complications, but they're more or less built on this simple form of fork join synchronization where you specify exactly the thread you're interested in. Yes, you could have an infinitely running thread.
Okay,
and you probably don't want to join to it. What kind of operation is this? That reminds me. It's a blocking operation. Has to be, right? Just like this has to be a non-blocking operation, doesn't make sense otherwise, this has to be a blocking operation. You can have non-blocking versions. What would that look like? What would a non-blocking version of join look like? Well, what's a non-blocking version? Again, this is an example of reusing the same idea we were talking about earlier. What was the non-blocking version of receive? How did that operate? How did the non-blocking version of receive operate for message passing? No, this is the receive operation, not the broadcast messaging. So you have a receive operation and, let's say, zero buffering. Okay, there's no messages there. How did the non-blocking work? Returned an error, right? It said there's no message, so it returned an error. The non-blocking version of join would do the same thing. Join with thread P. Thread P is not ready yet. The T join would return false or some kind of error message. That would enable the main thread to go off and do something and then come back and try again. Somebody mentioned timeout here. You could also do that. So you can have a timed T join. In fact, that's what I do for when I run your operating system. I say wait 10 seconds, I guess it is. And if you don't join with the other thread within 10 seconds, return. So when that returns, I know that this operating system has been running for at least 10 seconds, and that's way too long, so I just kill it. All right, so that's an example of using a timed join to control the behavior of another thread. Pretty much we're done. There's actually other interesting things we could talk about, but those are just filigrees on the basic idea. Are there any questions?